When Hashem commands us in terms of building the Mizbeach, there's a specific commandment that sounds very difficult to understand. Lo sala b'mala al mizbechi, ashelo segalat ervos chalov. Don't go up steps. When you build the ramp to go up to the Mizbeach, don't build steps so you should not reveal what should be covered. You should not reveal your erva. And Rashi explains what this significance and why specifically the Torah commands us to build a ramp to go up to the Mizbeach and not to use steps. Explains Rashi that the Kohanim wore tunics. The basic beged elyon, the top beged of the Kohen, was a flowing almost robe. And even though underneath the robe they wore michnasei bad, they wore linen pants, nevertheless, if they were walking up and if they would take a step, it would be something that would be considered a bazillion, an embarrassment to the steps. Why? When you lift up your leg, you're almost showing your erva, so to speak. You're almost revealing yourself, even though, again, they're wearing michnasei bad, they're wearing undergarments. But it's something that's a bazillion, it's an embarrassment, it's not appropriate to the stones. Therefore, the Torah tells us when you build a way to get up to the Mizbeach, for the Kohen to rise up, don't build steps because then he'll have to lift his legs. When he lifts his legs, it'll be something of an inappropriate action because he's somewhat showing his erva, again, even though he isn't, but it looks almost like it. Therefore, use a ramp. When you use a ramp, the Kohen can take small steps. He won't have to spread his legs very far, and therefore, it won't be an embarrassment to the keves, to the ramp up. And if Rashi stopped there, it would be interesting. But Rashi goes on, V'redvarim kal v'chomer, and is a kal v'chomer. If avonim, if stones which don't have das, have no understanding, to be makbid about their embarrassment, yet the Torah says, since they're an object of importance, you shouldn't act in a way of bezoyin, you shouldn't act in a demeaning manner. Chavercha, your friend, shubidimos yosrecha, your friend who's an image of Hashem, and he's makbid, and he is bothered by his embarrassment, al achas kama v'kama, so much more so. So Rashi learns out a Musar lesson from this losasei. When the Torah tells us to be worried, to be concerned about not embarrassing the stones, surely, says Rashi, how much more so we have to be careful about not embarrassing my friend. If a stone is an inanimate object, doesn't feel embarrassment, yet the Torah says you have to treat it with respect, surely my friend who's created in the image of Hashem and feels his embarrassment, so much more so should I have to be careful and concerned about his embarrassment. And that's how Rashi explains this. And if you think about this Rashi, it's very difficult to understand. Why? Because what we're talking about is one of the holiest men of the generation in one of the holiest spots in the world doing one of the most holy activities. We're talking about a Kohen who's involved in bringing a korban. He's walking up to go on top of the Mizbeach and to bring the parts that have to be burnt onto the Mizbeach. He's a person on one of the highest madrigas we could ever imagine. In a place, he's in either the Beis HaMikdash or the Mishkan, in a very, very holy place, engaged in an incredibly delicate procedure. Of course he has to treat the keves, the ramp to the Mizbeach, with honor. It's one of the holiest objects in creation, in one of the holiest places. Of course he has to be careful. What connection does that have to do with a plain, simple human being? Rashi's saying it's a kal v'chomer. If you have to be careful about the rocks, the stones that would be the way of getting up to the Mizbeach, surely you have to be careful about a human being. That kal v'chomer doesn't work. Why? Because this is one of the holiest objects ever created. Of course you have to treat it with honor. Of course you have to be careful about it. What connection does that have to do with some Tom, Dick, or Harry, some regular guy in the street? This is such a holy object. Of course you have to be careful with its honor. You don't have any right to learn from there to anywhere else. And I believe that this question is fundamental. And when we focus on the answer, I think is a life lesson of incredible significance. And to do this, let's focus on something that I've mentioned in previous times that it bears repeating. It's a Mishnah in Sanhedrin that explains that by all rights, Hashem should have created the world in a very different manner. The reason for creation is to give man the opportunity to grow, to accomplish. The reason for everything in existence is because Hashem wanted to give the human being an opportunity to grow, to become a vastly greater person. So explains the Mishnah, by all rights, the first moment of history should have been at Har Sinai. The first moment of creation should have begun with 600,000 men, women, and children gathered at the base of Har Sinai with Hashem saying the words, Anochi Hashem Elokecha. That should have been the first moment of time. However, that's not the way Hashem created the world. Hashem created the world from a very, very different point. Hashem began the world with one human being, put him on the planet. That one human being begot another, begot another, begot another. And all of those generations that came out till finally we came to that moment where the Jewish nation was gathered at Har Sinai. Why is it that the Torah didn't begin? Why is it that creation, that humanity didn't begin at the right point at Har Sinai? Why did it begin much earlier? To teach us one fundamental principle. To imagine the following. When Adam HaRishon, the first man, opened his eyes, he saw a complete world. The rivers, the trees, the oceans, the birds, everything in creation was already there. As a man invites his friend, before he has his friend come in, he sets the table, cooks the food, has everything prepared for the banquet. So too Hashem prepared an entire world. And when Adam HaRishon opened his eyes, he saw a perfect, complete world for him and him alone. And explains the mission of the lesson that we're supposed to learn is that it was worthy and proper for Hashem to create an entire cosmos, an entire solar system, and everything that stretches out for one human being. In fact, that's what Hashem did. Hashem created the entire world, put one man in it, and the lesson that we're supposed to learn is that it was worthy and appropriate for Hashem to create an entire world for one man and one man only. And then the Mishnah goes on. Lefikach, therefore, kol echad ve'echad, every human being, chayev lomar, is obligated to say the words, bishvili nivra olam, I too am a man. And for myself alone, it would have been worthy for Hashem to have created an entire world. Adam HaRishon was a man, so too am I. As Hashem created an entire world for one man and one man only, Hashem would have created an entire world for every one of us. And that lesson is so fundamental that Hashem couldn't just teach it to us on Har Sinai. Hashem couldn't just include it into the Torah. It had to be something that we could look back at and feel, experience, to imagine what it was like, to imagine what it was like to be Adam HaRishon and open your eyes and understand the significance of his importance. And each of us are obligated, not permission, not we should, we're obligated to say the words, Bishvili Nivra Olam, Hashem would have created an entire world for me and me alone. And this concept, if you think about it, is a bit heady. I often wonder, what is it that I could do that Hashem would have created an entire world for me? To put this into more clear terms, in our world, if you become a very important person, they name things after you. You can get a street named after you, maybe a boulevard, an avenue. The Triborough Bridge is no longer the Triborough Bridge. It's the RFK, Robert Kennedy Bridge. The George Washington Bridge, the FDR Highway. You have an airport, Kennedy Airport, LaGuardia, airport named after Mayor LaGuardia. So in our world, if you're a very, very significant, very, very important person, they name things after you, streets, airports, highways. But could you imagine a human being who's so important that they name an entire city after you and you alone? This is your city named after you. And forget a city. How about a country? A country named after you. We're not talking a country. We're not even talking a continent. We're talking an entire planet. And here's the question. What in the world could you ever do that's so significant, so important, that Hashem would have created an entire country, continent, planet for you and you alone? And I'd like to focus this question a little bit because sometimes we don't quite take it seriously enough. The Brisker Rav asks an interesting question. He says, the Ramban asks on Chumash, the Torah says, the Yom Elokim lo tov heyos Adam levado. Hashem says it's not good for man to be alone. Hashem created Adam, and Adam was alone. Hashem said it's not good for him to be alone. E'eselo eize kenegdo, I'll make him a helpmate opposite him. Ask the Ramban the question, that's not correct. The reason why Hashem made Chava was not because Adam was not good alone, he needed a helpmate. The reason why Hashem had to create Chava was because you need the rest of humanity. It's only when you have a woman, can you have children, can you have a next generation, can you have humankind. If Hashem would have created Adam in that state and not created Chava, that would have been the end of humanity, one man and one man only. So what does the pasuk mean that Hashem says it's not good for man to be alone and that's why I'll make Chava? There's a much more basic reason why we needed Chava, for there to be a human race. And that's Ramban's question. And the Brisker Rav says the answer to this is no. If it were just fine, had Adam been complete alone, had he been a Shalem alone, Hashem would not have created another Chava. There would not have been more human beings. Civilization, as we know it, wouldn't have been. Hashem would have created Adam and stopped. Meaning to say, it's not just theoretical. Hashem says it's worthy for me to create Adam and so you could get the picture. Quite the opposite. Hashem would have stopped at that point and said, done. I created a world. I created a man. We could stop. Meaning to say, if it weren't for the fact that Adam needed a helpmate, if it weren't for the fact that man alone isn't complete, Hashem would have stopped and said, we're done, the entire world for one man, it's appropriate, it's proper. And the question that begs being asked is, how could we understand this? How do we make sense of this? And I believe the basic answer to this question is, that we are sold a bill of goods by Western media, by Western thought. And that bill of goods is that, man, you know, he's okay. You know, he's there are some occupants of the planet that walk on 4 feet, some that walk on 2 feet. You know, some have different skills, some fly, some talk. But we're all the same. We're all occupants of the planet, all created equally, and we're all here in this together. And that is the greatest lie that's fostered upon us by Western civilization. A human being is so far above any other creation. A human being in importance, in significance, in value, towers over everything. He is the purpose and reason for all. And it doesn't mean if you're of Moshe Feinstein, and it doesn't mean if you're the Chazon Ish, any human being, from the highest to the lowest, it was worthy for Hashem to have created an entire world for one man and to have stopped. And why is that? Because that is the value that Hashem places on a human being. What we don't understand is the honor, the dignity, the importance of a single human being. And maybe we won't be able to even understand it now. But just this illustration, if Hashem feels that it's worthy to have created an entire world for one man, it begins opening our eyes to the importance, the significance of what a human being can accomplish. Now, as an observation, let's assume 60, 70 years ago, and we were in a village in Poland, and some Nazi group came in, armed to the teeth, and they said to us, okay, Jews, gather in the center of town. Here's your choice. You either give us a Torah scroll that we're going to burn or we're going to kill one of you. Make your choice. Interesting question. What's the halacha? Do you give up a Sefer Torah to be burnt or do you allow them to kill a Jew? And the answer is there is no question. It's obvious. It's pashut. You give up the Torah to be burnt. A human being compared to a Torah? We sell Sefer Torah for pidyon shvuim. If you have a captive person, you sell Sefer Torah to save human beings, not even a question. Okay, what if instead of burning a Sefer Torah, the Nazi said to us, okay, Jews, listen up. You know that synagogue in the center of your village over here? You either give us one Jew to be killed, or we're going to burn it down to the ground. What's your choice? Again, not even a question. What's it called? A building? It's a basic Knesset. So what? You know how important a human being is? A shul is very holy. A shul is very important. But of course you say to him, burn it down. To compare to a human being, there's no comparison in holiness between mere sticks and stones and and a flesh, live human being created in the image of Hashem. And even if the Nazis said to us, we'll burn every village, in every village, in every shul in Poland from here straight through, of course you don't kill a person. Because a human being is the holiest object in creation. And would you like to know what I believe the answer to this Rashi is? I'll give you a very simple illustration, and I think it'll click. Reuven is in shul, davening, with his tefillin on. And many people have a small tefillin on the tefillin shel yad, have a cover made of cardboard, a little cover. And imagine for a minute that Reuven's cardboard cover falls to the ground. Shimon comes by, picks it up, and says, oh, here, fell to the ground, and gives it to him. And Reuven says, thank you. Shimon says, don't thank me, I wasn't doing it for you. It's a davar shebekedusha, it's a holy object. I picked it up. It wasn't for you. That's because it's a holy object. Now let's focus on exactly what was happening there. What Shimon was saying was, this, the tefillin cover, it's a holy object. You, you're nothing. I'm going to do it for you. You're plain flesh and blood. This is a holy object. And what Shimon did was totally, completely reverse priorities. If he understood the value, the importance, the holiness of a human being, he would tremble. A tefillin cover, tefillin, Sefer Torah, shul, nothing. They're nothing compared to a live human being created in the image of Hashem. And if you'd like to understand this Rashi, I think it's very simple. Yes, the Kohen is a holy Jew. Yes, he's in the Beis Hamikdash. Yes, he's walking up the Keves, but that's nothing. The ramp going up to the Mizbeach is nothing compared to the honor, the dignity, the holiness of a Jew. How can you make a comparison? This is but stones. A Jew created in the image of Hashem is so much more holy. And what Rashi's saying to us is, if the Torah is telling us that even to inanimate objects that don't feel their bizarre, their embarrassment, we have to be careful, how much more so for the reason for creation itself, how much more so to a human being created in the image of Hashem who feels the pain? And this Rashi is a very, very powerful lesson in priorities, in ben adam lechavero, in how to view another Jew, and how to view myself. Because while it's true that every human being that I look at was created in the image of Hashem, and every human being that I look at deserves honor of incredible amounts, I too am a human being. And I too was created in the image of Hashem, and the regard that I have to have for myself and the demands that I have to have upon myself because of my power, the impact that I can have, are extraordinary. And this concept is fundamental, how I look at you and how I look at me. You are created in the image of Hashem, worthy of respect and honor of untold proportions. And I too am created in the image of Hashem, and I too am worthy of tremendous, tremendous honor and respect. But that's not quite the world that we live in. As an illustration, it was quite a number of years ago, I was a bach, I was in Eretz Yisrael learning, and I was on the bus, and I met, sort of sitting behind me, was Bob and John. Bob and John. Bob, hey Bob, hey John, good, man. Talking, friends, pals, buddies. The only thing about, a little unusual about Bob and John was that Bob looked to be twice the age of John. As a matter of fact, he looked old enough to be his father. And as a matter of fact, he was his father. But come on, we don't want a generation gap. Don't call me Dad. That's too distant. Call me Bob. Call me John. Yeah, we're just old buddies. We're all just here hanging out together. And the sad irony is that we live in a generation of disrespect. We disrespect all equally. It's an egalitarian society. We treat everyone with the same level of disrespect. We argue with our doctors, we argue with our lawyers, we disrespect everyone equally. And the concept of real kavod, honor, the concept of treating a person with the dignity due to them is almost foreign to our entity. As an example, I was a high school rebbe for many years, and I used to try this as an experiment. I would tell the guys as follows. When you go home for an Arab Shabbos, when your father walks in the room, when your mother walks in the room, I want you to stand up. But stand up doesn't mean kind of like half. No. Stand up to full height. And invariably, when a guy would do that, it would be the strangest experience. Oh my God, Well, the Queen of England just walked in, and my mother, I got to stand up. Kind of like his father would look, he would look. What is this? It's a halacha in Shulchan Aruch. Every Rishon, every Achron agrees. There's no discussion, no debate. If your Rebbe or your father or your mother walks into the room, you're obligated to stand up to your full height. But when you do it, it's kind of strange because what am I treating them like? They're honorable people, all kind of, some dignitary has walked in into our presence over here? And the answer is yes, exactly. And the reason it's so foreign is because we've become so cultured by the world in which we live that we forgot what the concept of respect, of dignity, of honor, of accord means. And we treat everyone with equal disrespect. And sometimes you get to see this in an interesting way. When I was a young man learning in Rochester, I befriended one of the high school fellows. He had recently come over from Iran, and this was a very different time. His parents still lived in Iran, and every once in a while he would speak to them on the phone. And things were rough. Things weren't so good. Jews still were alive there. They were still somewhat safe. In any case, one evening, he's on the phone with his mother, and when he hangs up the phone, he's crying, tears coming down his face. I walk over to him, I say, oh, what's happening, what's doing? So he tells me, well, my parents got into a fight, and my father punched my mother, and he fell down. I said, oy vey, your father hit your mother, oy vey. He said, no, that's not the problem, the problem is, and he went on to tell me what the problem was. Okay, I stayed with him a few more minutes, he calmed down a little bit. A little while later, I walked over to him and I said, I have to ask you something. There's one part about the conversation that I don't understand. You told me that your father hit your mother. And I said, oh my goodness, that's horrible. And you said the word, no, it's not so bad. That's not the problem. The real problem is why he hit her. Da, da, da. And you went on to tell me the problem that's going on there. I want to ask you a question. What do you mean that it's not so bad that your father hit your mother? And he said to me, of course it's not so bad. Listen, I'm not saying it should happen all the time, but it's good, you know, for a wife to get beaten every once in a while. It's good. It keeps her in a place. It's not so bad. But again, they were having financial problems. That's what the problem was. So that's why I was worried. There was nothing that I could say. There was no response, nothing I could say other than, wow. And I'd like to explain to you why this young man had that reaction. He was brought up in Iran. It's certainly then it was largely, it's an Arab country. And in Arab countries, a husband does and should beat his wife. Smack, crack, that's what wives are for, and that's how they're treated. And even though the Jewish nation never sink to the level of the goyim amongst whom they live, but unfortunately we adopt a lot. And to this young fellow, the concept of his father smacking his mother didn't really trouble him because that's the way women are treated, and that's okay because that's the way it's supposed to be. Baruch Hashem, we live in a very different culture, and even though we have many things that unfortunately we adopt from the culture we live in, the idea of a husband beating a wife and it being okay is not in our vernacular. It's not in our mindset. And I firmly believe that any person brought up in Western civilization understands that it's not just crude, it's utterly unacceptable, it's so out of bounds that you can't even deal with it. So on the one hand, we are far more enlightened and far more advanced than that young man ever was. But while it's true that we don't beat our wives, there is something else that we do that might be even worse. And that is, we destroy the underpinnings of marriage. If you listen to the way husbands speak to wives and wives speak to husbands, the disrespect, the dishonor, the words of degradation, the words of abuse that are said in common talk is absolutely mind-boggling. And I'd like to share with you why that is so significant. The Rambam gives us a formula for a successful marriage. The Rambam gives us exactly the system. He tells a husband how to treat a wife and a wife how to treat a husband. Hilchos Ishus, Perek Tes Vav, says the Rambam, Sivu Chachamim Shia Adam Mechabedes Ishto Yosem Migufo. Chazal obligated a man to treat his wife with more honor than he treats himself, v'ohava k'gufo, and to love her as he loves himself. A man's obligation to his wife is to treat her with honor, with accord, with respect, to respect her more than he respects himself, and to love her as he loves himself. Why is it that Chazal obligate a man in that? Because A, that's the required respect for any human being, and more specifically, because it's what a wife needs in a relationship. A wife needs to know that she's cherished, she's valued, she's held in high esteem. And when a woman knows that she's beloved, that she's cherished by her husband, she is satisfied, she's fulfilled, one of her most basic needs are met. And therefore, Chazal obligated a man to treat his wife with more respect than he treats himself, and to love her as he loves himself. And the flip side, Chazal also obligated the woman that she should be mechabedes es baala b'yos midai. She should treat her husband with honor exceedingly, with exceeding honor. V'yeh lav mora. And there should be almost an awe when she looks at her husband. She should be looking at him with awe, almost as if she's looking at a prince or a king. And in her eyes, all she wishes to do is to fulfill his desires and his wishes. A husband should honor his wife more than himself and love her as himself. And a wife should look at her husband, yosemidai, with tremendous, exceeding amounts of honor, wishing to fulfill his every bidding. And I'd like to share with you that if that is the way a husband acts to his wife and a wife acts to her husband, there will be a beautiful, harmonious, perfect shalom bayis. There won't be squabbles and fights and tiffs and issues and yelling and screaming and everything else that happens. It'll be a beautiful, perfect marriage. And while it's rare to see this properly fulfilled, I was zochet to see this. The Shiva Zatzal had a very open house, and I was often in there. And we as Talmidim got to see the Shiva act in his house. And we got to see the Rebbetzin. And if I would tell you the regard, the honor that the Rebbetzin treated the Shiva with, I don't even know if I have words to describe it. First of all, always in third person, always the Shiva. But more than that, we used to joke about who's the biggest chassidah, who's the most loyal Talmud, by far the Rebbetzin. Anything the Rosh Yeshiva said was Das Torah, was Emes Lamito. The Rebbetzin was the most loyal fan of Rosh Yeshiva ever. And at the same time, I'd like to share with you something else. When I was already a high school Rebbe for quite a number of years, and the Rosh Yeshiva Zatzal asked me to start Tiferes Bnei Torah, the Shmuz, etc., and it started becoming more popular, and there were many, many demands placed on my time. I was still a Rebbe in high school, but it was getting very difficult to balance everything. So I went to the Shiva for an appointment. The Shiva Zatzal already was old. And I came into the Shiva's apartment, and the Rebbetzin greeted me. We sat down. And I started telling the Shiva, you know, I'm very all day. I barely have time. I don't have enough time for my kids, my wife, and Mamish. I'm running, you know, between being a high school Rebbe and then going off giving shmuzim and shirim at night. I probably should have no time. Shiva stopped for a moment and he said, okay, I think you should stop teaching. Stop teaching high school. The Rebbetzin was in the kitchen washing dishes, and I heard the water stop, and I heard the clicks. As the Rebbetzin walked in, looks at the Rosh Yeshiva and says, is the Rosh Yeshiva sure? Is Shiva sure about that? Shiva thinks a minute. I think so, yeah. Okay. Now, I'd like to share with you what that conversation meant. In the vernacular, when a young man, and I wasn't even that young at that point, I was a father, I was a Rebbe, comes to ask Das Torah from a Gadol B'Yisrael, to his Rebbe, he travels in, makes an appointment, and asks a Das Torah Shayla that's going to determine his future, and whatever his Rebbe says he's going to do, and someone asks, are you sure? In our circles, that's called mutiny. What do you mean, are you sure? Why are we asking the Rosh Yeshiva? Because he has Das Torah behind him. He's a person of that stature. But you see, the Rebbetzin was very, very, very much a Talmidah, but she was also a partner with Rav Shiva, and Rav Shiva didn't look at her and say, oh, how dare you ask woman, who are you? Let me think about it, Taka. And I heard the Rav Shiva Zatzal say these words over and over. We were together. Everything we did together. We were partners. And when you see the mutual respect, the love, the regard, the honor one treats the other with, you understand the formula for Shalom Bayis, and you understand the way a Jewish couple should act. And unfortunately, it's not that common. And unfortunately, we have many, many, many Shalom Bayis problems. And so even though this may sound trivial, and it may sound like not needed, let me start from the beginning. Before we get into anything complex, number one, husband and wife have to be polite. They have to say excuse me and thank you and treat each other with simple derech eretz. Studies show something very, very frightening. A husband and a wife treat each other far worse than they'll treat a stranger. When they do videotapes of a husband listening to a wife and a wife listening to a husband, and then they take the same person with an utter stranger, and what they find is that with an utter stranger, either one of the couple will much more readily accept the stranger's opinion, will argue much less, far more polite than they are with their own spouse. And I want you to understand what that means. That means I treat a stranger with the regard to the derech eretz due to a person created in the image of Hashem. But this is my wife. I don't have to be formal over here. And even if you're sophisticated enough not to be that crude, how quick do we argue? How quick do we, what do you know? And even if we don't say, what do you know? But when you argue with a person, when a person expresses an opinion and you quickly shoot them down, what you're saying is, I disregard your opinion. You would never do it to a stranger, but to your husband or to your wife, whatever. And we argue and we discuss and we're very flippant. And I think that's something that, even though it sounds obvious, requires being said. We're polite to one another. We don't make jokes at the other's expense. We don't say things that are inappropriate, not dignified. And that's basic and it's obvious. And even if we're joking, it's not a joke. I don't know when I started this, but a long time ago, I made a conscious effort that when my wife would call, I would immediately run. If she was on another part of the house, another room, I would immediately stop and run. And maybe you say, oh, Machber and Shalom Bayis, very impressive, very nice. I'd like to share with you that it had nothing to do with Shalom Bayis. It had to do with a much more basic principle. I wanted my children to see that when mommy calls, Abba comes running. That mommy is a person that we have to treat with great regard. Because Abba listens, Abba runs, Abba says, yes, mommy, what is it? I wanted my children to be brought up in a home where they understood that the mother is respected and honored and treated with regard. And if you listen to the way couples squabble and argue, and even if they're not fighting, the disregard, the lack of politeness, the lack of proper dignity that they treat one another with, it's something that's frightening, and it's something that is very, very damaging, and I'll explain to you why. We spent a long time in one of the previous shmuzim discussing the fact that the glue of a marriage is love. The absolute basis of any marriage is the bond, the attachment, the love that a husband feels for a wife and a wife feels for a husband. And if there isn't love in the marriage, you are kaput, finished. There is no way that two people can live in the heavy traffic of life, make all of the decisions that they're obligated to make, go through all the busyness and things that we have to, and live in harmony unless there's a solid bond, an attachment of love between them. If there's love in the marriage, he's a good guy with a flaw, she's a wonderful woman with some issues. If there's no love in the marriage, he's a creep who never did anything right to begin with, she's a loser who I have no respect for, and in no time at all, that marriage will disintegrate. The glue of a marriage is love. What the Rambam is teaching us is that's only half of the equation. If you love your wife and your wife loves you, but you don't treat one another with respect, your marriage is in deep jeopardy. And I'll explain to you the why. Rav Feldman, in his book, writes about a man who had some serious Shalom Bayis problems. So serious that he came to Rav Feldman to ask for help. And Rav Feldman asked him some questions, and one of the questions he says he asked him was, "Tell me, how's your communication? How do you talk with your wife? How does that go? So the man said, "Oh, that communication, Baruch Hashem, we're great at that. That's not a problem whatsoever." And the man went on to explain, "Every night when I come home, we don't waste time with chit-chat. We get right down to business. I point out all of the things that she did wrong, and I explain to her what she could do better, you know, throughout her day. And so we waste no time. Our communication is great." Okay, now let me share with you exactly what this man was doing. This man was taking vinegar and pouring it into his wife's eyes. What a woman needs is to feel esteemed. She needs to feel cherished. She needs to feel that her husband loves and respects her. And when you say to a woman, "You did this wrong and that wrong and that wrong and that wrong and that wrong," what she hears is the exact opposite. She hears criticism, she hears words of rebuke, and she very clearly gets the message, "I'm no good. My husband does not respect me. My husband does not cherish me. My husband does not hold me in high regard." And what he does with those words is destroy the marriage. Because when a woman feels that she's not respected, not loved, not cherished, she doesn't feel good about herself. And guess what? She doesn't feel good about the one who's delivering that message to her. And he could be right. And he could be 100% right. But he's destroying his marriage. And one of the sad realities is that without meaning to, we cause so much damage, so much destruction to the basis of our marriage without even recognizing what we do. When a husband criticizes a wife, what he's doing is eating away at the core of his marriage. When a wife criticizes a husband, guess what? She sure is not treating him with excess honor. An honorable, dignified person, you don't criticize. And if you have to point out something, you're going to shower it, cover it with huge amounts of compliments and appreciations. And agav, one little thing maybe we could improve on, but you're not going to speak that way. And without meaning to, now without intending to, husbands destroy their marriage, wives destroy their marriages, and it's something that happens on a regular basis. Before you criticize, even if you're right, and even if it's important, say to yourself, "This had better be a very important point. This had better be something of major consequence, because I'm putting my marriage itself at jeopardy. The bond of the marriage is love, but love with respect. And if I'm hitting at that very core, I'm potentially damaging my marriage. I might be right, and I might be divorced. Or I might be right, but I may hurt my wife so severely, or a wife may hurt her husband so harshly that it causes a tremendous amount of damage and requires resolving." And this is not the shmooze to focus on the damage of criticism per se. There are others that do that. I think there's a more subtle part of the lack of respect that comes to play that most people don't realize. And I'll share with you what that is. Most successful marriages have irreconcilable differences. Marriage therapists say, studies show that 70% of successful marriages have these. It's probably even higher. An irreconcilable difference means a major life decision or issue that has no solution. She wants a larger home, and he wants to save for retirement. There is no middle ground there. She wants a dozen kids, and he feels that 5 or 6 is about as much as he can handle. He loves the Miami heat. She loves the cold. What are you going to meet midpoint, live in Minnesota? There are many, many issues that a couple who are successfully happily married will find that there is no solution. There's no pshara. There's no middle ground. It's either this or that, that or this. And amazingly, those couples remain successfully, happily married. But that's not the most shocking point. The most shocking reality is something that John Gottman shares with us. He's a marriage therapist, a psychologist who studies marriages in depth. He videotaped hundreds and hundreds of couples and studies the tapes over and over, and he studies marriages at their most base core. And in his words, most marital arguments cannot be resolved. Couples spend year after year trying to change each other's minds, but it can't be done, because most of the disagreements are rooted in fundamental differences of lifestyle, personality, and values. Meaning to say, a man and a woman are different, vastly different in temperament, in emotions, in priorities, in their whole way of viewing life. And a couple, as a man and a woman, were brought up in different homes with different ways of doing things, different ways of approaching things, different styles. And each of them have their own personality. And there are going to be thousands upon thousands of things that they're going to come in involvement with that require either this way or that way or this way, but a decision has to be made. And guess what? The idea that they're actually going to agree on everything is fundamentally absurd. There are going to be so many things that I like and she likes and I don't like this. How could it be that two human beings, how is it possible that two human beings are going to like everything the same way? And there are going to be many, many irreconcilable differences on major issues and even more so on minor issues. And there will be disagreements, differences of opinions about money and jobs and kids and housekeeping and chores and everything that you could ever think of, from what color the sofa should be to what color we should paint the house, living in this neighborhood or that neighborhood, this type of school, that type of school, every issue under the sun. In the la-la land of Hassan and Kala, when they get Google-eyed, they say, oh, we're in this together and we both look at things the same way. We're so compatible forever and ever. We'll always share the same mindset. He'll like vanilla ice cream. I'll like vanilla ice cream. He'll want the house painted blue. I'll want the house painted blue. And then they get married and reality sets in. And she realizes that, guess what? He likes green paint and he doesn't like blue paint. And guess what? He likes the house cold and she likes it hot. And he loves to visit his parents, and she doesn't. And when you start living together with another human being, you find there are untold amounts of differences. And the key to a successful marriage is knowing how to deal with those differences. Building the bond of love is essential. Spending time, making sure that you pay attention to one another and enjoy the friendship and love and build that bond is hugely important. Working on respecting each other, being careful how you speak to one another is hugely important. But if you have all of those ingredients, but you don't know how to deal with the day-to-day life issues that have to come up, the day-to-day differences of opinions and ways of doing things that have to happen in every marriage, if you don't know how to deal with them, your marriage will fall apart. You'll have a lot of trouble at least, and your shalom bayis will be compromised. And I'd like to share with you an observation, what I consider a very significant thought in this regards. A young man, typical young man, married for 6 months, comes home, whether it be from work or from kollel, and walks into his apartment and doesn't know what to do with the scene. He respects his wife. He holds his wife in high regard, and there she is, on a chair, screaming at the top of her lungs. Ah, ah, ah. What is it, dear? What? And he sees it. A little bug. Oh, my goodness. He walks over to the bug and steps on it. And in his mind, he says, oh, my goodness. What kind of crazy... What is with her? I thought she was a normal, sane, intelligent person. I think she's losing. I don't know. I don't know what to do with her. And what he just did was make one of the biggest mistakes a husband can make in a marriage. And I'll explain to you what that mistake was. When my children were little, my oldest son, when he was about 2 years old, loved playing with ants. If you ever saw an ant playing on the land, he'd play with it, it was a toy, it was cute. And his oldest sister was terrified of ants. Needless to say, whenever the kids had problem with bugs, they would call on Shalom Ari and go, quick, you get the bug. Because above him and under him were a bunch of girls. And girls are afraid of bugs. most of the time, that's pretty much natural. It's pretty much the way girls are. Girls are afraid of cockroaches and bugs and worms and they go. But guys aren't. Most guys are pretty comfortable with it. What this young man did when he walked into the apartment was looked at his wife with his eyes, looked at her behavior through his emotional mindset, and judged her very disfavorably. Oh my goodness, what kind of crazy dame? What kind of crazy, go screaming and ranting and raving, standing on a chair, what's wrong with you? Where's your sanity? Where's your sobriety? What happened to you? And she went down in his regard, but she went down in his regard for one reason, because he judged her using his system. And guess what? It's not fair, it's not accurate, and it's very, very dangerous. And I'll explain to you what happens. You see, he comes home and sees her on the chair, screaming about the cockroach, not a big deal. Until 3 weeks later, he gets a call in the Cola Alert work, wherever he is. Please, please come home. There's another one, another one. And he says to himself, oh my goodness, she wants me to leave where I am. She wants me to leave work, leave learning. Is she kidding me? Please, please, please. And she hangs up. Oh my goodness, I can't believe it. She wants me to leave the yeshiva. Go, she's great. Anyway, he's a mensch, so he gets in the car, but he's fuming. Where's the chashiva zatora? Where's the value for my time? What's wrong with this? What's wrong? She's an immature brat. I don't know what her problem is. He walks into the apartment steaming, red-faced. He's a mensch, so he doesn't say anything. He steps on the bug and says, I hope you're satisfied. And he closes the door, walks back to yeshiva. And of course, he's correct. A chutzpah for something so teeny, insignificant, to stop my learning, to stop my busy day, to step on a cockroach. And again, what he did was judge her by his reality. In his world, a cockroach is something you step on. But in her world, it's not quite that way. And what he was doing was judging her based on his reality. And because of that, he was doing something unfair and very damaging to the marriage. And I'm going to play out the illustration for a minute, because imagine for a minute that they have a discussion about it. And she begins working on herself, and she learns to find the can of Raid, and she learns to spray the bugs and not call them and bring them home. And she works on it and works on it. And in her mind, she knows how hard it is for her, how much she suffers. And when he comes home, she tells him, do you know, today there were two cockroaches. I sprayed both and I didn't call you once. And in his mind, he says, wow, Baruch Hashem, she's at least half normal. And what she hears very clearly is huge amounts of disregard. What a chutzpah. Doesn't he realize how much I worked for him? Doesn't he realize how hard it was for me? Doesn't he realize how much I was most in effort so he could learn, because I love him, I respect him, and this is what he gives me back? He gives me back this disdain, this look like I'm half normal now, Baruch Hashem? And inadvertently, without realizing it, he's done a lot of damage to his marriage. And while the particular of this case may not be that significant, the principle is. One of the biggest mistakes that we as spouses make is we judge our partner based on our standards, based on our reality, and it's unfair, unhealthy, and destructive to a marriage. You see, if I'm going to use my reality to judge my spouse, then guess what? She's going to fall short in many, many areas. And if she uses her reality to judge me, well, guess what? I'm going to fall short in many, many areas. And the reality is that men and women are vastly different in temperament, in nature, in approach. And you have to recognize, A, the difference in your spouse, and B, you have to recognize your relationship. If you are a totalitarian dictator, you have the rights to decree the terms of your marriage. If someone appointed you God, or someone appointed you at least Melech, then you have the right to dictate, this is how it shall be done in my house. But unless a Navi came and appointed you Melech, you're a regular husband or regular wife. And as a regular husband or a regular wife, you are Reim Ahuvim, friends who love one another, partners, equal partners with different roles. And not a single one of the partners was given the right to be boss. I'm in charge. This is my area. I'm in charge of this, and you shall follow my dictates. And without realizing it, husbands, and wives regularly dictate the terms of their marriage and cause tremendous trouble. We'll start with the more obvious ones that aren't so nasty. But here's the reality. From the time you were born, the world centered around you. As a little baby, your mother, your father waited on you hand and foot, bottle, change of diaper, everything was about you. When you got a little bit older, then what happened was, you know, the issues were, which is the best school for you? Where will you thrive the most? Is there an extracurricular activity that's good for you? Again, everything focused on you. You got a little older, the question was, which high school is best for you? Which setting will help you grow? Is this camp better for you or is that camp better for you? Where will you flourish more? When you got a little older, the question was, seminary or yeshiva, which is best for you? Which will help you the most? And then it was time for shidduchim. Which one is the best suited for you? Which one serves you best? Your entire life, everything was about you, and then suddenly you get married, and bingo, reality changes. All of a sudden, it's not you, it's us. And us always has two deus. Us always has two opinions. Us always has my way of doing it and your way of doing it, my approach and your approach. And thousands and thousands and thousands of decisions have to be made. And it's in those areas that I become totalitarian dictator and that I create a lot of trouble in my marriage. I am in charge of this area, and this is the right way of doing it, and this is the only way of doing it. And if my wife gives me a tough time about, all right, fine, I'll give in to you, even though everyone knows that blue paint is the best color. And even though everyone understands that the red couch was the better one, I'll do it for you, dear. I'm giving in to you, and I'm doing the wrong way and the wrong thing for you. And on the one hand, it sounds noble. Gee, generous guy, look what he did for his wife. And without realizing it, what he really did was dictated the terms of the marriage and dictated how things should be. And then he had to be so vile, giving in again to his wife. And the sharpness of this point only comes to bear when you focus on the real issues of life. Every single marriage has very real issues when it comes to the day-to-day habits and the day-to-day activities. Either he's too neat or he's too sloppy. She's too neat, she's too sloppy. He's always on time and she's always late, or she's always late and he's always on time. Either he's a huge tightwad and she's a big spender, or he's a big spender and she's a huge tightwad. I told you 9,099 times to put away the cereal after it's done, she screams. I told her at least 5,000 times to write a check, to check with me before she writes a check. And now we bounced another one. I can't believe I'm waiting here in the cold for 30 minutes, all because he's too inconsiderate to be on time. And if you focus on the vast majority of the fights, the issue in a marriage, they center around these points. It is appropriate, proper, and normal to be on time. And I'm trying to get my wife to be appropriate and normal. And for the life of me, she's giving me a tough time. I've tried time after time to get my husband to be neat. That's the way he's supposed to be. That's the only way to run a house. And I don't know what his problem is. Half the time he's okay, half the time he's not okay. And I'm getting fed up. I'm furious with him. I can't believe she's spending money like that. She's out of control. I told her and I told her this is not the way to do things. Everyone knows we're going to go broke. This is just not the way. And if you focus on almost all of the big deal recurring fights in the marriage, it's always because one partner has decided this is the way it needs to be, it shall be, and the other one must bend to my will. Now, if you think I'm just going off on a limb here, focus. Every single time you'll get into a fight, husband with a wife, wife with a husband, it's almost always about a recurring issue again and again that comes up. And you'll find that it's always the annoying habits, it's the ways of doing things where it's obvious and it's clear that he's got to change or he's going to cause trouble. I've told him, I made it clear, what is his problem? And again he did it, just to annoy me. Again he's done it. Now, what is the right approach? I'd like to share with you the right approach is almost there, but vastly different. And the right approach is that there is no right approach. You're neat, I'm sloppy, I'm on time, you're late. We, as a couple, have to try to help each other, meet each other's needs as much as possible. No one is a totalitarian dictator. No one is the boss, and no one is in charge. And what that means in plain simple language is each party in this marriage has a right to say, this is important to me. And when a wife says to her husband, dear, I'm very embarrassed when you show up late. It pains me. Then a husband had better get to work, and he better start getting on time. And when he's on time, his wife had better appreciate it. His wife had better say, wow, thank you. And when he's late, again, his wife better understand that that's the way he is. So does he have to change or does he not have to change? The answer is he has to change. But the reality is that change is very, very difficult. And when I've decided that the minimum standard is me, being on time means all the time, every time, and my husband doesn't live up to that standard, I've created a very false, unfair expectation. Much like the husband who walked in and saw the woman on the chair screaming and said she's nuts because he judged her with his system. If you by nature are neat, punctual, and on time, and your husband isn't, you don't have the right to say, this is the normal way, and Baruch Hashem, at least I've gotten halfway normal, and get furious every time he's late. You have every right to say to your husband, it's important to me. You have every right to explain to him why. You have every right to share with him your pain and embarrassment if it causes you such. And you also have to recognize that you have a need that he might not be able to meet all the time. And it's when you get fed up and furious because again he's done it. Again he's done it, and the tape in your mind starts playing this time and that time and that time. What an inconsiderate bum, what a creep, what's wrong with the guy? He just doesn't care. What you're doing is you're destroying your shalom bias. Every marriage has a number. It's not one, but a number of these things, some more egregious, some less. But it's learning how to deal with them that are the problems. You see, every fight between husband and wife is because of frustration. Every fight is because of frustration. Either it's frustration with your spouse for not doing what you want, or it's frustration because your expectation of your spouse are unfair. And the recognition that human beings have a tough time changing, and the recognition that my spouse is different than I, not because she's mean or callous or anything, but because by nature she is that way. And the reason she acts that way is not because she's defying me, not because she's giving me a tough time, but because that's her teva, that's her nature. Baruch Hashem, she recognizes that this is important to me. Baruch Hashem, she recognizes it and is working on it. But for me to expect perfection based on my standard, and me to draw the minimum standard as where I hold it and leave no tolerance for error, because how could, everyone knows that spending the way she spends, dressing the way she dresses is unacceptable. What I've done is I've become a dictator in my marriage, and guess what? I'm going to suffer. If you'd like one yesod to think about, it's friends don't boss friends around. If you have a friend, you don't boss them around. You don't tell them what's expected, what's done. Friends talk about things. Friends explain things. Friends look at the other's perspective. If you're married, that's supposed to be your best friend. You're supposed to be people who are re'im ahuvim, friends who love one another, best friends, and best friends don't boss one another around. And even if your mindset says to you, but this is the right way, this is the only way, everyone knows that being sloppy costs time. Everyone knows that being sloppy is just not as efficient. And you walk into your husband's office and you say to him, again, the place is a slob house. How could you live with it? And you're furious with him because you explained it to him and explained it to him, explained to him again, and he's still a slob. Does he have to change? Yes, because it's important to you. And you have to recognize that it's very difficult for him to change. And he'll get a little bit, he'll slip a little bit, get a little bit, slip a little bit. But you're not the dictator. You're not the boss. You don't set the standards. And you have no right to get furious when he disregarded my command. Again, if you were appointed king or malka by a Navi, we could discuss your rulership. But assuming that you haven't been, and guess what? You're a partner. Equal partners with different roles. And at the risk of drawing some strange looks from people, I'd like to share with you the three rules of a successful marriage. You see, there are only three times that a spouse has a right to say, this is unacceptable. I'll negotiate this, discuss this, but this is not negotiable. Would you like to know what those three things are? I would love to stop and ask everybody to write them down. But let me share with you what they are. Number one, if your spouse is engaged in an activity that's legitimately dangerous. That means he's driving 85 miles an hour. I don't mean if he's driving 2 miles over the speed limit. He's doing something that's legitimately dangerous, specifically if it's endangering you, that's non-negotiable, there's no discussion. You have every right to say, absolutely not. You cannot do that. Number one. Number two, the second non-negotiable is if a husband or a wife acts outside the confines of a marriage. If he starts talking to women in a way that it shouldn't be. If she starts doing things inappropriately with other men. Anything that's outside the confines of their bond one to another is non-negotiable. And number three, anything that's physically or emotionally abusive. No partner, no spouse has a right to abuse physically or verbally one another. But after that, it's all open season. Everything other than these three things are negotiable. Your way, my way, I'll do for you, you do for me. I don't know. What's the right way? I don't know what the right way is. Neat to sloppy, blue plank, back plank, cold to hot. I don't know. And we'll discuss it. How much does it mean to you? How much does it mean to me? We'll try to find a pshar. We'll try to find a mid-ground. We'll try to work it out. But in any other area, I don't have the divine right to say, this is the right way and you must bend to this way of doing things. And if you'd like to know how far I believe this goes, here's the illustration. Imagine the following. You come home. It's a Shabbos day. You just went to Shul Davening. You come home, ready for the Suda, and you see your husband on the sofa. And in his hand is a ham sandwich and a cigar. On Shabbos, he's eating a ham sandwich, smoking a cigar. At that point, you say, "This, it's absurd. He has no right to do that. I will not tolerate this. Absolutely not." And you stand there and command him to stop in the name of the law. And you have no right to do that. You do have every right to say that this is not the partnership that I agreed to. And I cannot be married to a person who does this. And you have every right to opt out of the partnership. But as a partner in the marriage, you have no right to say that this is the way it should be. This is the way it has to be. It's not the way he wants to do things. But the Torah says, so what? He's a human being. He's given free will. And you are not his Rebbe. You're not his boss. And you have no right to say to him, how could you do that? It's usser. Who are you? If you were his mochiach, if you were his musser Rebbe, then you should get up there and give him musser. But you're not. You're his partner. And as his partner, you could treat him with respect. You could love him. You could feel horrible that he's destroying his neshama, but you have no right to dictate to him how he should act. If you really feel so strongly that you can't live with this, and you might be right, you go to a Rav, and the Rav tells you, you're out of there. This violates the terms of our agreement, this violates our marriage, and I'm out. But you see, it's not a subtle difference between that and dictating. You have no right to dictate to a partner. You have a right to say this partnership no longer is viable. I have to be out of here. But you have no right to dictate. And many times I wish I could explain to a woman that what she's doing is sacrificing her marriage for her principle. I've decided that this is the most inviolable, sacred principle in the world. And madam, with all due respect, you have a right to do that and likely you're going to be divorced. And whether it's because you have to be on time, or it has to be neat, it has to be clean, it has to dress this way, or whatever it is, you've decided that you will dictate, what you're doing is you're destroying the basis of your marriage. I think what this Chazal are sharing with us is that there is a basic human need for respect and honor, because that's the dignity due to a human being. We don't focus on it in our society. In our society, we're very cavalier, we're all equal, and we treat one another with equal disregard. But what Rashi's telling us is that when the Kohen walks up the keves, he cannot spread his legs. You know why? It's treating the stones in a demeaning manner. And it's a kal vachomer. Surely so much more so to human being created in the image of Hashem. Why? Because Hashem would have created the whole world for one human being. That's the value, that's the regard. And that concept of Bishvili Nivra Olam is the cornerstone of all human relations. When I look at you, I look at a person created in the image of Hashem. When I look at myself, I look at a person created in the image of Hashem. I'm obligated to treat you with honor. I'm obligated to treat myself with honor. And as that is the cornerstone of Ben Adam L'Chaveru, it is one of the cornerstones to a marriage. The Rambam's formula is simple. The man has to respect his wife more than himself and love her as he does himself. A woman has to look at her husband and treat him with exceeding honor, almost as if a king or a prince is there. And when the couple work on the bond of love, when they treat each other as good friends, when they spend time with one another, when they spend time working on their marriage, and they're careful about the regard that they treat one another with, that love builds, the respect builds, they have a perfect, beautiful marriage, provided they know how to handle and deal with the issues that come up all the time. And those issues come up on the big deals, issues of life, and they come up on the little ones. Day after day, moment after moment, you have to live with your spouse. And this preconceived notions that we have that I dictate normalcy. This is the right way to do it. And, my husband just doesn't get it. And I'll have to slowly teach him is a very dangerous game to play. Because your tolerance will be directly related to how what you see him acting in an inappropriate way. Men are different than women. A man has to study his wife, understand what matters to her, understand her emotionality, and he has to be fair to her. And a wife has to study her husband, recognize what gets him angry, recognize what words and what phrases bother him, recognize what it is that ticks him off, and she has to stop doing them, even if she's right. And even if she's wholly right there in the bringing her husband up to the highest madriga, she's destroying her marriage. You're not in charge. You're not his boss. You're not his mother. You're not his Rebbe. And don't boss him around because you're destroying the marriage. And if nothing else, it's highly disrespectful. You wouldn't speak to a 5-year-old that way. You wouldn't speak to a kid in cheder that way. Why do you speak to your husband then? Well, because do you know what he did for the 1,000th time? He left his socks again on the floor. He didn't clean up his cereal bowl. I told him again and again and again, and I will not tolerate. I just will not put up with this. Okay. You probably won't. But Joseph is not going to be married. And if you are married, surely you won't be a happy marriage. So you mean he could be a slob and do whatever? No. He has to hold in very high regard your wishes. And for you, it's important to be clean. It's not the right way. It's your way. And he has to regard you and keep in mind that it's important to you, and he has to work on it. And you have to be realistic and recognize that likely he's going to get somewhere there, fall back a little bit, fall back a little more back and forth. When Hashem created us to be happy. Hashem created us a Ezer Kenegdo, the perfect husband for the perfect wife. But marriage requires work. And one of the first areas that a person has to work on, one of the first areas a person has to think about is the regard that I treat my spouse with. And I'd like to close with one last thought. It's a well-known story, but it bears repeating. Probably one of the most famous marriages in our recent history is Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and his Rebbetzin. And as you probably know, he said the words, there was never once that we treated one another with the type of language or expressions that we had to ask Mechila for. And if you'd like to know the secret to his marriage, many people say it was really quite simple. But no one realized it until later on in life. One day he was coming home, and one of his talmidim were walking with him. And as he's about to enter the apartment, before he enters, he straightens his tie, straightens his hat, make sure he looks presentable. And the talmid asks, "Is there a visit? Is there a guest? Is there some adam chashuv that the shiva has inside?" And Shlomo Zalman looked at his talmid and said, "Don't you know? When an ish v'isha ashruya b'shalom, when a man and a woman live together in peace, the Shechina is shorah between them. I'm going in to greet the Shechina." When he approached his wife, He understood the value of Shalom Bayis. He understood the value of a woman. He understood the value of a human being created in the image of Hashem. And he understood that when a husband and wife come together in peace and harmony, Hashem is happy, if it could be. Hashem is joyful, kavyachol. And Hashem is there. And when you treat your spouse with the regard due to a human being created in the image of Hashem, when you have that respect, you work on the love, you spend time together, it changes the whole relationship. And if you ever have shalom bayis problems, just try this. Don't criticize and make sure that you give your spouse as much respect as possible. You're going to go out, you're going to spend time, you're going to build the bond, you're going to do everything necessary, and you're not going to show any disregard, whether it be impolite words or quickly ignoring their opinion or making fun of or even things like criticizing for whatever the reason. And when you stop doing those things, the marriage builds and becomes stronger and stronger, becomes better and better. May HaKadosh Baruch Hu grant us the wisdom and ability to put this into practice.